Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Members of New Zealand's Muslim community say they will return to the final day of the anti-terrorism hui in Christchurch, despite yesterday's angry walkout. During a panel talk on the causes of terrorism, a comment from a Jewish council representative on the Israel-Palestine conflict prompted shouting and a sudden exodus. The country's first hui on countering terrorism and violent extremism is discussing how to mitigate the terrorism risk in New Zealand. Alicia Foon was there.
Jewish Council's Juliet Moses told the crowd that leaders should be consistent in condemning terrorism, adding that the military wing of Hezbollah is a proscribed terror group. She was interrupted by shouts of Free Palestine, and then at least a dozen members of Muslim communities got up and left. Ms. Moses says her comments were within the context of the hui.
No, I don't think it was inappropriate. This is something that very much affects the Jewish community. We need to leave what's happening overseas and work to unite and work towards peace in Aotearoa, New Zealand. It's disappointing that there were shouts of Free Palestine, because we need to be able to have civil debate and be a united country.
The Federation of Islamic Association New Zealand's Abdul Razak says the comments were always going to upset people.
Look, there are lots of things out there which divide us. Let us have some wisdom to talk about and prioritise what unites us first. When people inappropriately bring issues which divide us, that's not polling the tikanga. We are here as guests of the Tangata Whenua. On that basis, it was actually not appropriate for me to be there. And when I walked out, the rest of the Muslim community also walked out.
Azad Khan, founder of Foundation Against Islamophobia and Racism, All Fair New Zealand, also walked out.
Emotionally drained, frustrated, sad. And I really feel for some of the victims and some of the victims' families who were attending the hui. I think what has happened today was very hurtful. She was more than happy. I think she had the platform, she had the audience, and she was more than happy to espouse her ideologies and associate Islam and Muslims with terrorists.
Harz Murthesa, representing the National Islamic Youth Association, says it wasn't the time nor place to bring up the topic.
But as soon as she started talking about Hamas, Hezbollah, and started inferring that the Muslim community was linked to these terrorist organizations overseas, because that was highly insensitive and discriminatory and Islamophobic. But when you've got Shuhada martyrs and you've got the Muslim community present, then that's not a place to bring up grievances.
He says the Muslim community had already raised concerns about having Miss Moses on the panel. Afterwards, those who walked out were given a chance to respond to the comments, which included a remark from Rashid Omar, whose son Tariq died on March 15th, and he spoke about the hurt it had caused. Massey University sociology professor Paul Spoonley was a panellist alongside Ms. Moses. He hoped the day two hui would lead to some action, but warned the government wasn't working closely enough with communities.
We've got a lot of work being done in government departments, and some of those government departments and some of those government officials have very good community connections, but I don't see an equality or a partnership between government and these communities on some of the issues. Get them involved in a process and perhaps lead on some of this so that they tell government what should happen.
Today's final day of the hui involves another two panels discussing challenges of online radicalisation and then developing an Aotearoa approach to countering violent extremism.
A growing number of New Zealanders now see China as a threat rather than a friend. At the same time, New Zealanders feel closer to many Asian nations than before and are showing an interest in learning more. The findings are from the Asia New Zealand Foundation's annual survey of New Zealanders' perceptions of Asia and Asian peoples 2020, which has been running for more than 20 years. Chen Leo reports.
Just one third of respondents see China as friendly. That's down from 40% on the previous year. And more than one third see China as a threat, up from 21%. Jason Yang from Victoria University's Contemporary China Research Center blames the changing attitude on crackdowns in Hong Kong and on China's Uyghur population, expansion in the South China Sea, China's handling of the COVID-19 outbreak, and the deteriorating relationship between China and the United States. Mr. Yang says the growing perception of China as a threat has security implications.
I think that if that trend continues, then that would likely have a detrimental impact on the bilateral relationship and New Zealand's ability to achieve security and prosperity in the region.
He says more work needs to be done to find out why the shift has occurred. Respondents also think China is a key relationship that New Zealand should put more effort into building. Jason Young agrees.
We're still, I think, very far away from where we should be in terms of the type of courses and understandings and stories and knowledge that we have of such a large and important country.
The report finds more people viewing South Korea, Thailand, the Philippines, India, Vietnam and Indonesia as friendly compared to previous years. It also finds New Zealanders connect with Asia through a range of interests, not only food and travel, but also increasingly through music, art, literature, languages, politics, history and current affairs. Māori respondents also feel a sense of cultural connection with Asia and an interest in learning more. That has impressed the Race Relations Commissioner, Ming Fun.
More particularly, I'm heartened by how Māori feel about Asian people in terms of the relationship concepts and values of whakawhanaungatanga.
Executive Director at the Asia New Zealand Foundation, Simon Draper, says in early surveys in the mid-90s, New Zealanders generally view Asia as distant and irrelevant, but things have changed and now New Zealanders realise Asia counts.
New Zealanders are saying, you know, they see themselves as part of Asia, that Asia touches their lives in a way that it simply didn't when we started over 20 years ago. And it touches their everyday lives, where they travel, who their friends are, what they're reading, what they're eating, what gaming, all those things.
The Asia New Zealand Foundation has been tracking New Zealanders' perception of Asia since 1997. This year's survey by Coma Brompton polled just over 2,000 New Zealanders in October and November.
Auckland's public dental service has failed to clear a backlog of about 2,000 children waiting for urgent dental treatment. This is to put an end to painful toothache. The Auckland District Health Board vowed in November to fix the problem, with one board member saying it was keeping him awake at night. It committed $650,000 to clear the waiting list of 2,157 children by June, but the latest figures to be tabled at a meeting today show it has hardly changed. Dental Association President Katie Ayres is a paediatric dentist in Hamilton. She's with us now. Kia ora, Katie. Thank you for being with us today.
Good morning.
Why are these lists stubbornly high?
Well, I think the main concern is that despite an increasing number of theatre sessions being available, the number of children being referred every week tends to at least meet or perhaps be greater than the number of children being treated.
Is it in line with population growth, as in is it a percentage that is staying the same but because populations are getting bigger it's more individual people, or is it becoming a larger problem?
I think it's becoming a larger problem. I guess we've had more New Zealanders coming back to New Zealand over the last 18 months or so, but we haven't been seeing the immigrant children coming in that we were seeing prior to that, because often those immigrant children did have a lot of decay also.
A shortage of theatre space, why is that?
Well, there's just not enough capacity within the hospitals. They have so much other urgent work that's needing to be carried out in terms of medical surgery that the dental surgery just doesn't have an access to enough theatres. And also there are staffing issues as well. It's not just having the $650,000 is fantastic, but you actually also need to address the access to theatres and also having the right kind of staff that are able to undertake this kind of work.
What is the problem particularly with young children and tooth decay?
Well, you know, this report that's going to be tabled today says that by the age of five, 68% of Maori children and 75% of Pacific children already have tooth decay. And that's just a shocking figure. So what we really need to be doing is going right back to those children from the age of 1 year of age and making sure that they are accessing preventive care and are living in healthy tooth environments.
Fluoridation of the water is something that is divisive. And I suppose, what is your view on whether that should be happening or not and what difference that might make?
Well, we have no doubt that the extension of community water fluoridation will improve oral health, not only of children but of adults as well. So we are really looking forward to the government progressing this issue.
What more needs to be done here? I mean, I suppose, is it a two-pronged approach that you've got to deal with prevention, but you also need pretty urgently to deal with 2,000 children, young children, who are in pain as a result of waiting and waiting and waiting for the surgery?
Absolutely. And so the service is looking at that. They've started, for example, operating services on a Saturday, both to assess the children, to put them on the waiting list, but also to treat children. They've got an extra mobile theatre running in the area, which started in May and will be running through to July. And they're also looking at outsourcing work to private providers as well. But absolutely, they need to be doing a lot of preventive work as well, because the other thing that this report showed, that 61% of children haven't attended for dental checkups. So when they catch up on those routine dental checkups, they're sure to find more and more children needing referral for general anaesthetic. So the more prevention can be done and the more they can catch up on those checkups and preventive care, that should help over, you know, probably 2 to 3 years to reduce the number of children being referred into that service.
Ngā mihi, thank you very much. Dental Association President Katie Ayres.
No photo, no service. A rise in violence and racial abuse has led to a Northland publican to photograph punters and scan their IDs, or they won't be allowed a pint. The patron scan technology is increasingly common in Australia and other countries as well. And more bars and nightclubs here are looking to similar systems to make their venue safer. But a digital privacy expert fears that with essentially no laws governing their use, they are open to abuse. Hamish Cardwell filed this report.
Luke Revel owns the Butter Bar Factory in Whangarei and says in recent months, violence towards his staff and customers has been escalating.
Just this year, I've been punched in the head 3 times, kicked in the head 2 times. You know, people have threatened to stab me.
Are your staff subject to racial abuse?
More or less, it's aimed towards our security contractors out front. I've been witness to multiple times, you know, people calling them the N-word.
But it was witnessing the shocking death of a young man in a street brawl last week that spurred him to act. He had earlier bought the patron scan system after a fellow publican boasted to him that violence had halved on the nights he used it. Luke Revel is rolling it out for the first time this weekend and will use it on evenings he considers high risk and for events that pull in a younger crowd. Affectionately dubbed Stan the Scanner, patrons will have their IDs scanned and their photos taken. The machine checks the IDs are real, that punters are 18 and over, and whether they've been banned or flagged for bad behaviour. Luke Revel says the information can be held for up to 90 days, but he'll delete it after just 2, as a concession to those worried about privacy.
It's really a trade-off. Do you want to just give up that little piece of information? They'll be stored securely for 48 hours only and, you know, have a greater sense of safety in a bar or a venue.
Only he can access the information, although there is an option to allow the police in too. The system allows other bars with the technology to share data, so if a troublemaker gets turfed out or banned in one place, others can follow suit. Matt McLaughlin, who owns a number of bars and nightclubs in Wellington, says he expects the system to become widespread. He says being able to share information is a big bonus, stopping people booted out of one venue from wandering up the street and causing problems in another.
Having something like Patron Scan means that if we do see any issues of violence or sexual assault or vandalism or something that does warrant taking it to the next step, we're able to look back and try and figure out exactly who these people are. Can we have them arrested? Can we have them banned from our premise? Can we have them banned from the area?
Digital technology expert Dr. Andrew Chen says there is no process for what a person can do if they find themselves mistakenly blacklisted from every pub in town, or if they've been maliciously flagged by a publican or bouncer.
There is a word for it, which is Kafkaesque. this is pretty much exactly what is in the story of the trial. And essentially, because people don't necessarily have a right to appeal, or there may be a right to appeal, but it is not clear how that might be exercised.
Dr. Chen says there are essentially no laws covering this type of technology, besides the most basic privacy rules around consent, and that it is collected and used for a specific purpose and is deleted when no longer needed. He says it is hard enough to establish meaningful consent at the best of times.
A simple privacy statement that is shown at the entrance is actually insufficient for people to genuinely understand what rights they're giving up in order to enter the premises. And so even if you're sober, I would question whether or not that was genuine consent.
Dr. Chen says while the system may not use facial recognition technology now, it will almost certainly become available as the technology improves. He doubts the government will step in and write laws to govern the area. It will likely take people being harmed by an error with the technology and challenging it in the courts before rules are established.
Back home now, burglary numbers are trending down across the country. The latest crime and victims survey was released this morning and shows a significant reduction in burglaries per household for much of the country. But the survey also shows disabled people are significantly more likely to be victims of crime. Tim Hampton, the Ministry of Justice's Deputy Secretary, told reporter Ben Strang burglaries have steadily declined over the past 3 years.
It looks as though COVID might have played a bit of a role in the last year, but it's pretty clear that that downward trend has been in place for some time. It does remain quite an important issue. You'll see that it's still, you know, one of the top three or four types of offences that people suffer, and so therefore it does remain an important issue, even though it has come down. And so for that reason, police and others do remain focused on prevention for burglary and other crimes.
The survey says that households in Auckland are significantly more likely to experience offences such as burglaries than other places. Is there any reason for that, and are there things that people in Auckland can do about that?
In terms of the variation that we see across the country, what we'd have to do, and we haven't done it for the purposes of this report, would be to look down and see how much of that can be explained by differences in average age, income levels, etc., because we know that those factors are typically determinants of whether people are more likely to be a victim of crime or not. When we think about the victims of crime, there's two things that we really want to do. One is to make sure that the perpetrators are held to account, and then the second thing is to make sure that the victims of the crime are being well supported. And there is varying degrees of support across the country. What's happening more and more is that those supports are being provided by at the community level and much more focused on what's needed in that community, but also for those individuals, rather than just a one-size-fits-all government program.
Just moving on to the people with disabilities. The report mentions that people with disabilities are significantly more likely to experience crime across all offences. Is there a reason for that?
What the survey shows is that people with a disability are much more likely to be a victim of crime than somebody without a disability of the same age. Once you adjust for someone's age, a person with disability is 40% chance of being a victim of crime, and that compares to 30% for the New Zealand average. So that's quite a difference. We find that that applies across a range of offences, whether that be personal offences, even burglary, which, again, it seems strange for why disability people should be more susceptible to a burglary. But what it highlights is it's an area that we need to work carefully with and in more detail. The family violence and sexual violence strategy that's been developed at the moment is, among other groups, consulting very heavily with people with disability to find out what their needs are so that they can be better supported.
And that was our reporter Ben Strang speaking to the Ministry of Justice's Deputy Secretary Tim Hampton. Police have revealed they stopped two planned mass shootings around the time of the Christchurch terror attack after they were tipped off by members of the public in both cases. The police's National Security Advisor Cameron Bailey told me the police is heavily reliant on such leads when it comes to preventing terror attacks.
In both instances, as in so many cases, it's a report from the public that puts us on an investigative journey that leads us to discover what potentially is going on. And in many instances, sometimes the answer is nothing at all, can be mistaken, or something like that. But in both instances, it was some reporting from the public. And it should also be stated that reporting from the public you know, sometimes can only just give you a clue that you need to be interested in a person and what they may be doing, can sometimes be quite vague. So I don't want to go into the specific details of each case, but I just want to note that in both cases, it was because someone in the public saw something or heard something that concerned them and made that known to us.
That was a lead for your investigations or for agency investigations. Did that require warrants? Did that require sort of a more formal process of investigation then?
In both cases, I think I can say that the investigations did lead to using warranted powers to, you know, enter the person's home and conduct searches and things like that. So, yes, in both of those cases, the investigative work did lead to the creation of a warrant.
And were there any lessons learned from that? Were there things where, in particular, you were like, well, we need greater powers or we need new tools?
I think the key lesson in those cases, because the tools that we had did work, but in both cases, the key lesson is, and it's the lesson that also highlights the situation with 15 March, is that you do need that start point. It's also very scary if you only have one start point that, you know, can be a bit vague and could easily be deprioritized if it doesn't, you know, provide a clear enough indication that it warrants rapid action. But you do need that start point, and you need to make sure that when that comes in, that opportunity is taken.
So when we're talking about the public identifying risks, what are some examples of that in general that you can say in terms of things that might spark interest that would prompt someone in the public to report something?
For example, in the case of the concerns at the school, a student was simply sharing the concern that there was a person at their school who really worried them in the context of conducting some form of violent act at that school. It provided just enough information to give some texture to that concern and to enable us, when we received an anonymous report about this discussion online where this person was disclosing they had that concern, there was enough information that the officers conducting the investigation were able to work out who that person sharing that concern was, to go and proactively speak to them. They had indicated they might report directly to us. They hadn't yet done that. And then work forwards in terms of identifying the student they were concerned about and whether or not there was any grounds for that concern. So it's not always a case of that someone's able to give us, you know, detailed plans or anything like that, but it's enough information to sort of substantiate that, look, this is something you should look into.
And this issue of white supremacists and people radicalised in that vein, has there been a greater focus now, as is required?
Yes. As the Royal Commission report indicated, we were interested in that and concerned about it beforehand. We could see it rising overseas, and there had been quite a lot of work initiated to get a bit of grip on that issue within the country, and driven by public reporting as well as that work post 15 March. You know, we've identified more people, some of whom have come out of the woodwork because of the events in Christchurch. That issue was also a rising concern across the globe, and we're sort of following that trend, and it's a major area of work for us.
The two cases you mentioned in your speech, were they related to white supremacy?
Well, I was quite careful to say that they were potential mass shooting events, and I noted that one of them was a potential school shooting. That individual seems to have been primarily motivated by their local grievances at their school, but they were also consuming that kind of extremist material, and it likely impacted how they thought. The other individual does also appear to have shared that kind of extremist worldview as well.
And that was the police's National Security Advisor, Cameron Bailey, speaking to me a short time ago.
The police have apologised to the Transport Agency over their account of what happened after a road worker's death in Wellington. Their original account showed police wanted an urgent ban on a type of truck handbrake that failed, but the agency took a long time to do this. This prompted the man's family to label the agency careless and callous. RNZ's Phil Pennington is following this. Phil, kia ora, good morning. What's going on?
Susie, I've been reporting for several weeks on truck handbrakes that have failed and killed several people. Now, in this case, a park brake called a Samasiki. It failed and Georgie Bilo, who's 25, he was a Nauranga Gorge as a road worker. He was killed. That was 2 years ago. From his family's point of view, 2.5 years on, they've yet to see the trial start under health and safety laws. That's of three companies and one individual. And like any family, you can imagine, caught up in something like this, they really wanted to know clearly and as soon as possible what went on between authorities, police and the transport agency. And instead, what we have here is a real tangle.
So what then is the raru-raru? What's the problem?
Well, what we've got, when we asked about this last month, Wellington Police came back with us with what appeared to be a straightforward account, but this showed that there was some frustration and struggle in getting NZTA to do anything about these handbrakes in the sense of getting them banned. Police wanted something done by the end of 2019. Then headquarters of police came back to us and said, oh no, that account from our Wellington police is wrong. Now, they haven't told us what did go on, and now we have a new OIA, which mostly shows that the police concern, after we reported the story, was not to upset NZTA.
How does this make sense? What else is coming to light?
Well, the context is that we know from sources that South Island Police had been raising concerns about these brakes for years, going back to 2010, and they wanted something done. Now, the Wellington Police put out this account to us, then the National Police Headquarters came to us and said it did not reflect their national discussions with NZTA. I've gone back to them several times for the last month saying, well, what is the accurate story here? Because the Bilo family, they still don't know. Yesterday, police told me the account from Wellington was based on one work group's perceived understanding of the situation without considering the national approach in its entirety.
What does that even mean?
Well, we're still asking that. I had a long talk last night with them. A new OIA response, though, that we got. This is showing that police apologised after the story came out. They then apologised to NZTA, say, about the way that it was represented by the account that came from their Wellington serious crash investigator. Remember, this investigator is the person closest to this case. They told NZTA, this is the headquarters of police, that this account that we were given had not gone through the police national headquarters review process. Road Policing National Director Superintendent Steve Greeley told NZTA this instance wasn't representative of their positive, close, collaborative relationship with TA. And police media then set about creating a response for Mr. Greeley to give back to us, which is what he did.
Is that damage control?
Well, they wouldn't call it that. The original account, though, was not a good look for NZTA. Wellington Police said it didn't keep them in the loop. We have this a long time dealing with these brakes. The Wellington Police said NZTA didn't want a brake ban as it could impact truck operators. We have another OIA that's separate from NZTA, which shows that in October, 7 months after Mr. Bilo was killed, they were telling the police that they couldn't find replacement parts for these handbrakes, so they're trying to look for other options.
The Bilo family, though, can't be the end of it.
No, it's not the end of it, and for them it's very tough. As I say, they're still waiting for this trial. They're still waiting to find out what's been going on. The trial has been adjourned. The hearing keeps being adjourned, and they're waiting for that. And, of course, we have had other families who have spoken out, very unhappy about the collaboration, coordination that there's been, or lack thereof, between, for instance, the police, WorkSafe, NZTA, and other cases of serious road crashes.
Namihi, thank you very much. Phil Pennington, RNZ reporter.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.